I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about ideas and inventions with Rich Hanley and guests. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Your kitchen cabinet glows, and you simply open its doors and begin talking on Skype with a friend or relative that you can see. Think what this means for children and grandparents, no matter where they live. This is the idea of David Rose, an inventor and instructor at the legendary MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His new book, Enchanted Objects, is a fascinating read because it explains how technology, human desire, design, and purpose meet up to improve our lives. On our fresh edition of ICE, Innovation, Creativity, and Exceptional Ideas, regular contributor Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University and I are going to interview MIT's Rose about his guided tour of what's coming or already here. Rich, welcome back.
Good to be back, Faith.
I can't wait to do this in the weeks and months ahead. This is so much fun. And Rose will be with us after our first section. But Rich, let's talk about some ideas that we've been cruising. And these are things that we're noticing. And in this hour, we're going to open the phones to you. You were terrific callers last time telling us what you'd like to see invented. Rich, a man called in to say, look, the car is the perfect wind machine. Why can't we outfit it with little propellers somehow so that the wind generates the energy for that car or fuels the electricity system somehow? And I loved what he said.
Yeah, it seems logical that the car, as it moves, can generate its own power that allows it to move, which would be, you know, the ultimate machine because it generates its own capacity to move without the addition of any force other than the initial surge that requires you to get up to speed.
Well, we see people putting up all these propellers, these energy saving propellers, and harvesting wind, worrying about locations in the country that are not windy enough, thinking about where can we put these around people's homes and businesses to capture the most wind? What's the design? Tremendous worry about putting these giant propellers offshore, these wind farms, and, you know, despoiling the sea. Here is something so obvious from this caller about attaching these propellers somehow to cars. I don't know what it would look like or how it would work, but I loved it.
You know what the most important thing there is that people are thinking of these things. I mean, the idea of ideas is now part of our everyday culture, and I think that's the most exciting piece, is that folks are looking at stuff and saying, ah, I have a better idea. I wonder if that can be done. And they're talking about it. They're sharing it online. And as a result, I think it's a lot of energy that's going to help humanity sort of get our way out of some corners we found ourselves in because of previous generations of technology that didn't work out as planned.
And this is why Rich Hanley is the perfect person to do this show with. All right, Rich, let me run this by you because this was something. This appeared very recently in the New York Times. And it was an opinion piece by Anna Fells. Anna is a psychiatrist and faculty member at Weill Cornell Medical College. So she has a great history and is a true professional in her work. And she says this, the idea is putting a mind-altering drug in the drinking water, which sounds like sci-fi stuff. But her point is that it's already being done, that lithium is a naturally occurring substance in our water, and that when you look at studies in the science and medical world, in neuroscience, you find that the places where lithium is highly concentrated in our water, there is a lessening of depression in that population. And she says there is a dramatic drop in suicide. And so the article, in a way, is asking the question, is our future going to recommend that some small amount of lithium be given to everybody in the water in the way that we use fluoride? Now, we are not suggesting that people run out and start taking lithium because that would not be a good idea. But this is a fascinating idea to float and for people to think about and look at.
I mean, it's a way, you know, for folks to think about, you know, chemicalizing the water supply for the benefit of everyone, you know, in ways that haven't been thought of before. And this is a consequence of big data, the capacity to conduct studies and link study A, the percentage of lithium in a given body of water, with a reduction in B, suicides. The fact that you now have data sets that can talk to each other, and very smart people like Anna here can make these conclusions and draw these conclusions based on this data and then present those conclusions in the form of ideas, I think point us to a future that's going to be quite dramatically different from what we experience now. I don't think, you know, obviously, as you said, Faith, people are not going to start dumping lithium in the water, but it does point to a way to solve a public health problem. We have a public health problem. What's out there already existing that we can use to solve it? So the unexpected nature of these discoveries, I think, is very exciting, as long as it's kept in perspective and the response is appropriate, you know, to a public health issue as opposed to mind control or something that a totalitarian regime would find most useful.
Yeah. Okay. So here's another one. Again, the New York Times. So we're always cruising, clipping. I have scissors, and I'm constantly, clipping out things. So here's this, Rich, as you know, there's a guy, Walter Mischel, and he's a professor of psychology at Columbia University. He is the man who did the famous study. They call it the marshmallow test, where it is a legendary experiment on self-control. He invented this 50 years ago. And you can see the video. And he sat down 5-year-old kids. They're sitting at a table with cookies on the table. And if the kids were told, if you resist eating anything for 15 minutes, we will double the amount of cookies that you eventually get. And then they followed the kids who understood that they were going to benefit and had self-control. They followed them later in life and found that the kids who had self-control from that experiment were so far ahead in terms of their outcomes later in life than the kids who didn't, that it was remarkable. So now this Dr. Mischel is coming out with a new book. He's now 84 years old, and it's called The Marshmallow Test, Mastering Self-Control. He said, you know, when I did that test 50 years ago, people missed the point. He said, the point that I was trying to get across is that self-control can be taught. It's a muscle that you exercise. And so he said, you know, willpower is something that it's not just innate in some people and not in others. We can learn this stuff. And so let me quote a bit of what he says here. Part of what adults need to learn about self-control is in those videos of those 5-year-olds. He said the children who succeeded turned their backs on the cookie, pushed it away, pretended it was something non-edible like a piece of wood, or invented a song. Instead of staring down the cookie, they transformed it into something with less of a throbbing pull on them. Adults can use similar methods of distraction and distancing, he says. Don't eye the basket of bread, just take it off the table. In moments of emotional distress, imagine that you're viewing yourself from outside, or consider what someone else would do in your place. When a waiter offers chocolate mousse, imagine that a cockroach has just crawled across it. If you change how you think about it, its impact on what you feel and do changes, he writes. He explains that there are two warring parts of the brain, a hot part demanding immediate gratification, the limbic system, and a cool one, goal-oriented part, the prefrontal cortex. The secret of self-control, he says, is to train the prefrontal cortex to kick in first. Now that is valuable information. Those are great ideas.
Right, and the war inside the brain that goes on constantly in a consumer society like America is one that deserves, you know, intense study, because we're bombarded with stimuli to buy things and to consume things immediately. Those nice shiny packages in the grocery store, come here, come hither. You know, I want a potato chip. You want me? And you have to. We have to basically train ourselves to defeat this bombardment of messages that give us instant gratification. So I know an idea that I think the doctor has really hit on in a major, major way is how to neutralize that war in the brain so there's a good public health outcome. So this is beyond just the individual. This has to do with the way we as a nation, we as humans live. Because if we can show self-control, we won't get diabetes.
Rich Hanley is here from Quinnipiac University, and this is a fresh edition of what we're doing together, an ongoing series called ICE, On ICE, Innovation, Creativity, and Exceptional Ideas. We have coming with us, David Rose is going to be joining us shortly. He's an inventor and instructor at the legendary MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His book, Enchanted Objects, talks about all kinds of things that are here and coming. So I can't wait to talk to him next. Rich, we've got a caller already. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith.
Hi, Michael. Great, thanks. I'm glad you're with us. What's your idea?
Okay, here's my idea. Instead of having these big, ugly black solar panels on the top of your house, why not decorative solar shingles that you could shingle your house in, perhaps, or a business, or anything like that?
Michael, I wish you had thought of this. Let me see.
Oh, is it already out?
Yes, it is out there. There are solar shingles, and I didn't know this until a couple of years ago. And I was reading something in a magazine, and there it was, these solar shingles. And they were being tested on commercial buildings in particular, and there was talk of them being available to homes. So you have a great mind for this kind of thing. And let's see how fast it gets to us, because I haven't seen them in stores yet.
Yeah,
okay, nice going, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Okay, you're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on ICE, and then we have David Rose. Wait until you hear about these inventions and ideas. Kind of mind-blowing, I think. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now we have a description of the book we're about to talk about and our guest, David Rose. This is On ICE. It's a fresh edition. This is the show where we look at innovation, creativity, and exceptional ideas. And that's why we're so excited to have David Rose on. His book is called Enchanted Objects. It's about design, human desire, and the Internet of Things. And he discusses in here what's here already and what is coming. And it's pretty mind-blowing stuff. He is a teacher at the MIT Media Lab. He has his own company called, he's CEO of Ditto Labs. I absolutely love this guy. This is one of the most fascinating books I have read in years. If you want to know what is really happening and coming out there in a smart way, where we're merging design, purpose, meaning, our humanity all together, this is it. It has to do with the cloud. It has more to do with that interconnectivity in a different way, not these slabs of glass, our smartphones, these simple things that we're talking about. David's going to explain. Welcome to the show, David.
It's great to be here. What a nice introduction.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm here with Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University, who's my partner on this show. So please explain, as you do in the book, why you've chosen this title, Enchanted Objects.
Absolutely. So as you said, anywhere you go in the world, people are looking down increasingly at these black glass slabs, and these devices really monopolize our attention. And I felt like there has to be something better. There has to be a better way to interact with technology. And what we're seeing through research labs and through this new generation of embedded computing are devices that talk directly to the cloud that are ordinary things. They're things like a light bulb, jewelry, surfaces like desks and coffee tables. All of these things can now become connected, and where the apps that we used to use on our phones can spring off of the phone and into these everyday objects. The cover of the book has an umbrella on it, which is a product that I developed when I was head of ambient devices. And the umbrella isn't very complicated. It just has some LEDs at the bottom of the handle that know what the forecast is for the day, and the LEDs glow a little sprinkling pattern so that you don't forget the umbrella. So, you know, that's how simple this type of interaction could be.
So, in other words, the umbrella is signaling us in our homes or in our offices that rain is expected. Don't forget to take me.
Exactly. I mean, it's funny that people stay up late to watch the news to get the weather, where they don't need to know the weather before they go to sleep at night, or they shouldn't have to access an app to see the weather. They should just have the weather information happen right at the moment before they leave the house so that they don't forget to take an umbrella, for example.
Would you describe for Rich and for me the ambient orb that you created?
Yeah, so I this was a device I invented about 13 years ago. The insight was that a lot of the information that people care about is on websites, but it requires that people sit down at a computer or look at a smartphone and look up information. And instead of having to do that intentionally, instead if you could put information in people's periphery, then you could glance at information almost out of the corner of your eye without any effort or without any cognitive load. And so this was a grapefruit-sized frosted glass beautiful bulb that glows any color, and so you choose which information you'd like to that you care about the most, and then you can map it to this orb, so it glows more green as the stock market goes up or more red as the stock market is down, or it can be mapped to the pollen count, it can be mapped to whether your plants need watering, and increasingly we found that when you put this in people's lives, they're more attuned to this information throughout the day, and it really changes people's behavior. They're more likely to walk more steps if they can see that they haven't been as active, or take care of their diabetes better if they know their blood sugar levels sort of at a glance. So the company today is really focused on helping energy companies to give away this device so that people understand how much energy they're consuming, how much electricity they're consuming in their home.
David, it seems that the trajectory is pointing toward an enhanced self-awareness away from traditional media slabs, be them a screen, a newspaper, or an audio slab called radio, or some sonic arc. It just seems like our everyday life has all these cues. We just need a method to receive and interpret those cues, and technology is forming that solution to the problem to give us enhanced self-awareness about weather, about what to eat, about what to wear, and so on and so forth. Is that where you see the interconnectedness going, in terms of these smart devices or devices that have these embedded networking capabilities with the capacity to signal things that give us help with our decisions in everyday life?
Yeah, that's right. I in the book, I talk about six wishes or longings or desires that we've always had, where people have always wanted to know all, or a desire for omniscience. They've always wanted to connect with people, a human-human connection or telepathy. They wanted to be safe and protected. They wanted to live a long life. They want to move effortlessly, and they want to create and make and play. So personal expression. So I divide the Internet of Things up into this periodic table, which sort of clusters them into these six aspirations, which, you know, they're almost superpowers, right? If you look at the history of comics or the history of enchanted things in stories, stories from Harry Potter or myths like Icarus, like to fly, oftentimes these aspirations are what those magical powers are about. And so in many ways, these internet-connected things, which change our relationship to technology and how we think about technology by embedding it just in the ordinary, everyday fabric of our lives.
As you point out, ordinary things made extraordinary. We're talking with David Rose. He's an inventor and instructor at the legendary MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rich Hanley is with me, fresh edition of On Ice, which stands for Innovation, Creativity, and Exceptional Ideas on this show. How about the technology-enhanced medicine cap? This sits on the top of a standard amber plastic pill container. Tell me about what this does. I thought this was great.
Thank you. Well, I started a company about 6 years ago that tried to address this problem that about 50% of the U.S. is prescribed something by their doctor, some medication to take every day, and about half of us take it as the doctor prescribed. And it has to do with forgetfulness. We don't believe we need the medication. There's no social support. There's no accountability to a doctor. So we tried to address some of those root causes for not what the industry calls non-adherence by making internet-connected medication packaging. So what we did was we started with the base of the amber pill vial, and then this cap, which looks a little bit like a Pope's hat, which sits on top of the cap, has an LED inside that glows. It plays cute little arpeggios, so that if you don't pay attention to the glowing, you may pay attention to the arpeggios. And then if you still haven't taken the med, you know, a couple hours after your time, then it will text you or call your home phone. And probably most persuasive for many people is they can sign up a family member to see the days they did or didn't take their meds every Saturday. And so, you know, I see an email that comes from my dad's glow cap, and he sees one from my glow cap, so we can give each other a hard time or encourage each other or celebrate the fact that we're on the right path. So it uses sort of the combination of reminders and social incentives, and there's some people that are using this for transplant medications too, where it's really critical that you don't, you know, you take your immunosuppressant so you don't reject the kidney, and that sometimes the transplant coordinator gets the data as well. We did a study with Harvard Medical School and got people to, they found that people took with the glow cap their meds over 95% of the time, which is really just a game changer.
And for people, can you explain how you are harvesting all, how is this connected? How are you doing that in that cap?
Well, there's just like every enchanted object, it talks, these glow caps talk wirelessly. They send a little bit of data to the internet. In this case, it's only, was the cap opened or was it not opened? And if you assume that if the cap wasn't opened, they probably didn't take the medication out from inside. And that's, you know, that's sort of one simple switch catalyzes all these other services like automatic refills and social support from your family. I think the lesson here for the Internet of Things is oftentimes the incremental cost is very, very low. To put this, chipset inside of a pill cap is less than the price of a single medication often. But it absolutely changes people's behavior and allows the drug companies to sell more meds and the insurance company to reduce hospitalizations and individuals to just be healthier.
David, all these suggestions and ideas really stem from your approach to solving problems. How do you approach the use of ideas to solve a problem that you detect, such as the folks' inability to comply with medical directives?
Yeah, I think there's so many categories that are really important that these connected devices solve. I mean, we talked a little bit about health. There are transportation interventions, I would say. We did a internet-connected bus stop that allows people to see how many minutes until their next bus is coming.
Oh yeah. Let me stop you right there, because this is sensational, this thing. Explain, the problem is that, as you say in the book, people give up after waiting a certain amount of time because they don't really know whether the bus is coming, is it late, is it going to come at all? And after about 15 minutes, people walk away.
Right. Well, it's a little bit like waiting for an elevator. You know, you your anger level is really non-linear based on the number of seconds you have to wait. You know, you sort of expect to wait 10 or 15 seconds. If it's an incremental 10 seconds, you sort of forgive it. But if you have to sit there for 45 seconds, you're like, you're really pissed at the building management. And it's the same way with buses, we worked with a company called NextBus, which puts GPS pucks on the tops of buses. And what they found is that one of the biggest indicators of whether people will or won't wait for the bus is how long they have to wait. And what's so painful about waiting is just a lack of information. And so if you give people information, in our case it was sort of this big 9-foot-high lollipop-like display that is a stalk that sits there next to the bus stop and is viewable from a couple of blocks away and counts down so you can see it from a couple blocks away. And that's really important because an ideal public transportation experience is one where you arrive at the subway or the bus stop and you step directly on the train or the bus. And if you knew a couple blocks away how many minutes or seconds until it comes, then you could have a conversation with someone, you could do some shopping, you could get a coffee, you know, all the things that you would want to do before without having to rush to the bus stop and then stand there for 20 minutes and not know, you know, how many seconds until the bus is coming.
And so where is this operating?
You know, this was a prototype that we did for NextBus in San Francisco, and signs have been rolled out in various various public transportation settings, especially like Washington, D.C., but no one has adopted this sort of bus stop in a rural setting, which I think is really where you need the information most, is when you don't have other people or other transportation streaming by.
Wow. I just think that one is just fantastic. How about this wallet that becomes harder to open as you, I guess, approach the limit of your available funds?
Yeah, that's right. So this is an example of taking an ordinary object and an ordinary gesture. So it's a man's wallet, man's leather wallet, and the gesture that we all do every day is like we open our wallets to get credit cards out. And you know, since this was a project with Bank of America, they had the insight that as more people use plastic, people don't really feel how much cash they have in their pocket. So there's no feedback loop of when you're blowing through your budget for the month. And so we added a variable strength hinge to the wallet, so as you're closer to exceeding your budget for the month, the wallet gets gradually open, harder to open. So you sort of feel the you feel the effort required. And what I love about this type of haptic display, so it's a touch-based display, is, you know, there doesn't need to be a screen anywhere in sight, and it doesn't have to be distracting, it doesn't have to send you a text message, you know, it's just taking an ordinary object and an ordinary gesture and just adding a little bit of feedback to that moment.
I think that's the critical distinction in your work, David, is that we are so used to equating technology with a screen and some sort of interaction with that screen. This is taking ideas and basically scattering them into our everyday lives in ways that we couldn't imagine. And as such, this is technology that's going to develop, you know, I think, in a much more effective way, you know, in terms of helping humans get through their day. I mean, is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think it really will impact, from a business perspective, almost every category of product company out there. So if you're a company like, I don't know, Coach or Tumi that makes wallets, or a company like Samsung that makes luggage, or a toothbrush maker, or a trash can maker, or a leather recliner maker, or a weight scale maker, or a bicycle maker, I mean, all of those categories are thinking hard and should be thinking hard about what does it mean to have an internet-connected component or a sensor that can be on your device, and many cases less than a couple of dollars, and somehow send information about the use of the device or receive information or connect through people. I have this notion in the book called the ladder of enchantment, which where we think about taking an ordinary object like a trash can in a kitchen and thinking about what are the steps that you would use in order to make that trash can connected with some sort of service. So the service that we picked was Amazon, since they're, that signals in many people's minds how we order goods through e-commerce, and they have a new grocery company called Amazon Fresh. And so we embedded, so we called it the Amazon trash can, and we embedded a camera and a barcode scanner on the lid, inside of the lid of the trash can, so the system would automatically know what you're throwing out, and then could propose that if you wanted to reorder the same thing, like you threw out a box that contained a toothbrush or some packaging, or it could also propose a better version of what you ordered, like something sourced locally or something that would be slightly healthier for you or something that would be slightly more affordable. And our metaphor at the end of was that there's somebody that lives in the trash can, like Oscar, and he makes he makes these suggestions as you throw things out. And if you don't like his suggestions, you just kick the can and to sort of undo his recommendation.
The trash can Siri is what we're talking about.
Yeah, right.
So we're going to take a break, a quick break, and then David Rose, I want to ask you about this in terms of where things are going, because you talk about this in your book. Are we going to see more and more? Is this a big opportunity for entrepreneurs out there to pull existing things together to make new stuff and not for a lot of money? So stay with us. We'll be right back with David Rose from the MIT Media Lab, author of Enchanted Objects. Stay with us. Thank you so much for listening to us. I'm Faith Middleton with Rich Hanley. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, FaithWNPR, or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. And cheers to our talented team, producers Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. Rich Hanley is with me for this fresh edition of On Ice. ICE, standing for Innovation, Creativity, and Exceptional Ideas. Our special guest, David Rose, author of Enchanted Objects. He has his own companies, had many companies. He is a teacher at the legendary MIT Media Lab, and his book is one fascinating read about what's here and what's coming in terms of things that will make life easier, improve our lives. This is design meets purpose. And meaning. It's very, very interesting stuff. So here's my question for you, David. I'm told that there has never been more entrepreneurial activity than now. And if that's the case, you know, right up to this moment, a lot of us think, oh, well, we have these ideas, but, you know, where are we going to find somebody who knows how to write code? How am I going to afford that? And you make the case in the book that this is now a different time, that it's not so much about that. It's how to use the things that already exist in our collected already and stored in clouds, put them together to make this idea of yours happen. So it's not that usual code writing stuff. Am I explaining that right?
Well, I agree that it's never been easier to be an inventor or a maker of products, and especially this new category of products, which are both hardware and software mixed in a new way. I think one of the big changes is there are crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter, and I would encourage everybody to go to Kickstarter and another one called Indiegogo, which have a plethora of ideas and videos, and you know these are places where people come up with an idea, they make a video, they make a little bit of a prototype, and then millions of people get to decide whether that's something that they would want in their life and would they be willing to pre-order it.
Now, let me ask you a quick question about that, David. What in going to the site, are you giving your idea away to someone else who's going to do it?
I've never really been worried as an entrepreneur about copying and copycats, especially for these internet-connected things that are, it's still a fairly, you know, relatively hard thing to put together the team that is the makers of the software, the app, if there's an app, the hardware, the mechanical engineering, and I think the feedback that you get from people on these websites is so much more important than protecting your idea. I mean, the goal is to get an idea out into the market, and so if you can use Kickstarter, you'll get lots and lots of people to react to your idea, and they'll tell you, well, I think it should be more like this, or I think it should be smaller, or I think it should also have this other functionality. And then you can accumulate orders, and that gives you confidence, but it also gives an investor or a manufacturer confidence that you have a real company that can scale. Just a quick story. I'm working with a company that is called SunSprite. It was founded by two Harvard psychiatrists who have a strong belief that bright light, if people get bright light in the morning, they may not, that will improve their mood, it'll improve their sleep pattern.
Right.
And a lot of people use light boxes or they try to get out, but it's very hard to know whether you've gotten a half an hour at 10,000 lux, which is the sort of prescribed dose. So they made a little wearable button that includes a little patch of solar itself, so you never have to recharge this thing. It recharges itself. And they put it up on Indiegogo. They raised, I think, over $75,000.
Wow.
From pre-orders.
What a good idea.
Yeah, and then they got a manufacturer, and the thing just launched a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, and they're off to the races. You know, they have a little team of five people, and if you think about what it used to take to make a product, it was a multi-million-dollar, probably multi-year process. But a lot of the components are there to be assembled.
What's it called?
It's called SunSprite.
SunSprite?
No, SunSprite.
Oh, Sprite. Huh. Interesting. Okay, writing that down. We're going to check that out here on the show. So is this is really a matter of taking things, the data that already exists is what I'm trying to say, and teaming those different parts up in different ways to make new products.
Well, the sensors that are often embedded in these objects and the displays, whether it's a sound-based display or a light-based display, and the connectivity components, the either Bluetooth that connects to phone or a little Wi-Fi chipset that connects to a home network or a cellular chipset that connects to a nearby cell phone tower, these are all available. And, you know, especially the telcos like AT&T and Verizon are very friendly and eager to have more things connected to their networks because they see this as a huge opportunity to create customer value, customer stickiness, if you have more things connected to your AT&T account.
So this bike that has a back wheel, is it the back wheel? There's a special wheel you attach to your bike. And how does that work? What does it do?
Yeah, so the problem that the Copenhagen Wheel is trying to solve is to try to encourage more people to commute to work. And one of the reasons why people don't commute to work, surveys say, is that people are worried about arriving at work sweaty. And so this is a hub that can retrofit onto any bike because it has a standard width and just looks a little bit like a bigger flange. And it embeds a battery and an electric motor and a wireless chip so that you can control it from the handlebars, and it allows you to put very little effort into bicycling, and it, you know, gets you there twice as fast.
So on a major hill it would kick in, and on a straightaway or a downslope it just lets you go.
What I like about it is it's taking the existing architecture of bikes, and it's imbuing that with you know, retrofitting that architecture and that infrastructure, I should say, with a little bit more capability.
Rich Hanley is here from Quinnipiac University and our guest on this fresh edition of ICE, Innovation, Creativity, and Exceptional Ideas is David Rose. He's author of Enchanted Objects from the MIT Media Lab. You have two alumni who from the lab, right, who created this little plastic square they call Twine. What does it do?
Oh, yeah. So Twine is it's almost like a little Lego piece that because its function is so flexible, it can be programmed with this programming language called if this then that. So you can write these very simple sentences like if it's wet, then send me a text message, and you can just drop this little cigarette pack sized block in your basement, for example. So if your hot water heater is flooding, it will send you a text message. Or you can drop it in your hot tub and you can say, if it goes below 80 degrees, then ring my phone. Or, you know, so it has temperature sensors and moisture sensors and light sensors. You can plug other sensors into it, and then you can just sort of program your way into having a smart house.
This comes down to making us all feel more safe, doesn't it? That primal need for safety.
I think there are a lot of safekeeping applications. The ones that pop into my mind are, you know, there are a lot of internet-connected locks now that allow you to know who's entering your house, that allows you to walk up to your door and have the door automatically unlock. And if you're using Airbnb, it allows you to grant access just to those people that should be granted access and just for that day or 3 days that those people are there. And there's another internet-connected object I think that's interesting for safekeeping, which is this company called Tile. And a lot of people lose their keys or are worried about losing their keys or their wallet. And this little chip called the Tile it talks to your phone or talks to any other phone that uses this app. So if you tape one to your bike and your bike goes missing and somebody else walks by your bike and they use the same app, it will sort of tell where the bike is. So it's sort of a never lost aspiration.
And that would work for pets too, right?
Right, yes.
So embedded in the collar so that if the dog is taken or lost, you know where to find it.
You know, David, the one issue that is, you know, seems to overwhelm all issues of technology is the one of privacy. When we have this environment of interconnectedness, where it means we're creating data about ourselves in every possible way imaginable, you know, according to these devices that you described, how do we secure that? How do we make sure it's hack proof? I mean, where are we in that stage of development in terms of security and privacy?
Well, I think we're still early. I mean, there's both the technical question about whether firms are using the encryption protocols that they need to use that secure, for example, our banking transactions, and many people aren't. But then there's also just sort of the policy decisions that designers are making about can you reset the device? Like, can you get the device to forget everything that it knows? And how long is the data stored? And is the data, is it an opt-in or is it an opt-out policy? I mean, with the GlowCap, we were very careful to both encrypt and also to make all services opt-in. So it would only remind you as a default. And then if you wanted to share the data with a family member, you could choose to do that. If you wanted to share the data with your doctor, you could choose to do that. If you wanted to have automatic refills from the pharmacy, you could also choose to do that, or you could turn it all off. So I think that's a really important issue to think about from a designer perspective. I've been wearing a device that I think is especially interesting because of this privacy border crossing issue, which is it's a life logging camera from a company called Narrative, and it's about the size of a quarter, and I just pin it to a tie or your shirt or a backpack, and it takes a photo automatically every 30 seconds. And what it compiles for you is, at the end of the day, is pretty interesting, which is, you know, a portrait, a time-lapse portrait of your day. And you can discover things about how often are you indoors or outdoors, or checking your cell phone while you're watching your kids, or how often do you snack, or, you know, all these other questions you might have about your day. But it certainly crosses a line, I think, in terms of, you know, do your friends consent to have their photos taken? Or what about your family members? You know, if brands could look at that stream, what could they discover about the use of consumer packaged goods in people's lives? I mean, it's really a rich data set now that you've collected it. And now the question is, you know, maybe you want to post it on social media like Vine or YouTube, and, you know, then it becomes interesting in terms of how your friends feel.
Can I quote you here, because this is I like this. The future of enchanted everyday objects will follow this trajectory. We will have fewer devices with singular control and more swarms of functionality. Not one smart thing, but 1,000 just smart enough things coordinated, working together. Rather than having one bright light to illuminate a room, we will have a swarm of pin spots able to shine and focus their light where it's needed. Rather than a large window washing scaffold that progresses slowly up the skyscraper, we will have a swarm of small wash bots that scour the windows when needed. Transportation gets smaller too. Think minivans rather than city buses. Even police work will take advantage of atomization. So the swarm is what?
Well, the swarm is, I think, the diversity of tools that we will have in order to achieve what we want to have. I mean, I draw a parallel in the book to looking at other mature tools. Like, if you think about the knives we have in our kitchen, most of us don't have the one perfect knife, but we have a diversity of knives, some for bread, some for chicken, some for
fish,
deboning. You know, most of us have 5 or 10 different versions of knives. We have different versions of glasses. We have different versions of shoes. And, you know, if you go to my grandfather, as I talked about in the book, is a woodworker, and he has dozens of chisels, and they all look the same to me, but he knows the difference between them, and he needs those different specializations of a tool in order to work with his craft with as much dexterity as he had. So I think that's the trajectory for our technology tools, that they will become, these interfaces will become more diverse and more specialized and more redundant, but ultimately nicer to work with.
Is this so fascinating?
Right. No, I think it would be, you know, useful for the listeners to just, you know, take an inventory of the objects around their home and understand that these objects can supply them with great information about how to improve their lives if those objects were projected through some embedded chips or sensors, as David presents in his work. I think they did that. They'd get a great and clear understanding of how useful and what a great utility it would be to go in this direction.
You know, we have less than a minute, but I just wanted to say, in your book, you tell the story of a city somewhere where the waste cans on the street have this ability to be compactors, and they send out a signal to the rubbish companies, and so they know when the trash can is full. And so instead of just cruising and waste all that people power and gas, and they know, oh, I've got to go get this one, and that trash can, because it's compacted, is storing much more trash. This is how cities are going to get smarter, and this is how we can too. love this book and talking with you. I hope you'll be a guest again, David.
Absolutely. Thanks for being interested in Enchanted Objects.
Okay.
Thank you.
By David Rose, and thanks as always to Rich Hanley, my partner on ICE. And as always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails that we feature right now at foodschmooze.org, or search The Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.